Today's show is brought to you by FreshBooks. It's smart mobile accounting designed specifically for freelancers and small business owners. You can try FreshBooks for 30 days on us with no credit card required. Go to freshbooks.com/sports and enter sports in the How You Heard About Us section. The most disappointed people on Combine Day when people test badly aren't the players. It's the scouts that really fell in love with them.
Bill Pulling was the GM at the time. Said, here's how it works. We find guys we like in college. We scout them, and then we root really hard for them on the Combine Day because we have hard and fast measurables that they have to achieve. And if a guy we like doesn't get the hard and fast measurables, then we have to take him off the list.
Welcome to the MMQB podcast. I'm Robert Mays. He's Andy Benoit. And we are coming to you again, awkwardly, live from the same hotel room, this time in Indianapolis, Indiana, where the NFL Scouting Combine has been held since before I was born, I believe. It was like 1986. Do you know the exact answer to that?
No, I don't. I was born in 86. I don't recall back then. You're staying at the JW Marriott. We're in a very nice hotel. You are. I'm down the street at the Hyatt, which is also nice. But JW is like the hub of the scouting combine. The lobby is full of NFL bigwigs. And now Robert Mays.
It was cheaper than the other hotels. That is 100% true. And if the Time Inc. accounting department or expense department has an issue, they can look at hotels.com and the screenshot that I have just so I could cover myself. This is my, I want to say, fifth combine.
Is it?
I went when I was in college twice. Which is very strange. I was covering guys at Mizzou, and they'll literally accredit anyone for this. It's so easy to get a credential that I just decided to go twice while I was in college. So this is, I believe, my fifth one. My first time staying at the JW, but I think that by this time, we have combine, I don't know, maybe traditions is the wrong word, but we understand the rhythms of this week more than we probably used to.
So my first one was 2010. It was my first year out of college. I was working at CBS. I was part of the Eye on Football blog with Will Brinson and Ryan Wilson. And I was the only one that came. I didn't know I'd have to go. It never occurred to me you go to the combine. So we had just gone to the Super Bowl a few weeks before. And I had that settled in, like, post-season feeling. You're like, now I'm home. Things are all settled down. Then I got told I was going to the combine. I was the only one that went. They did press conferences. Coaches come in every day. I learned that you don't actually see the workouts here. We don't have any better view of the combine than anybody at home. In fact, there might be a worse view because our TVs don't have sound in the media room. So I bailed on that and just spent the whole week running around from hotel lobby to hotel lobby, hoping to bump into people and introduce myself. I didn't know anybody. Nobody knew who I was. And it was a lot of just cold calling, whatever. What do you call cold calling when you walk up to someone and approach them? Like cold approaching? What would you call that?
I don't even know. I think that's just ambushing someone. I think that's literally what it's called.
That's how it felt. Like, all right, one quick aside. I saw John Elway that year and went up to him and hey, Mr. Elway, I'm with CBS. I just want to introduce myself kind of thing. He clearly didn't want to talk. Sometimes that happens. Guys just don't, he's going from A to B. He's walking through one of the lobbies. But the mistake, it was just me and him around, him and myself around. The mistake I made was, as I'm saying hi, I stepped on the escalator with him. So right as it's apparent he didn't want to talk and I had nothing to say, it was supposed to just be a hello, we had like a 15-second escalator ride to endure. And I didn't know what to... So all I did was compliment his newfound Twitter account, which totally erased me from John Elway's list forever and really erased him from mine, because on the off chance that he ever remembers that encounter, and he won't, but if he did, I wouldn't want my face reattached to it.
You never get into a brand new interaction with someone when they don't have an out. That's pretty much the rule.
I know, and it didn't hit me what I'd done until I stood onto the escalator. But anyway, that's what the combine's like. When you're new, that's what the combine's like if you're wanting to meet people. And CBS wasn't too thrilled that year that I didn't write a single story from the combine. None of it seemed important, though. The coaches get up there and say nothing in the press conferences like they do all year long. So I went around just shaking hands with everyone. Fortunately, now I know people, so I don't have to go up and approach out of nowhere so much. So it's more fun now. But I remember getting very familiar with all the different lobbies, the hotel lobbies.
We'll get into the actual relevance of the Combine later. I mean, we'll talk about the Combine and what it is later in the show. But first, let's get to some of the news, just because it's been a full week since he recorded. There's been some stuff that's popped up. Nothing super groundbreaking, but stuff that happens around this time of year. I think we'll start with what Bruce Allen came out and said yesterday, more or less that RG3 is not going to be back in Washington, which is not news. We knew this was going to be the case. But just hearing them confirm it and being able to move on completely, and all of us in our minds are saying, okay, that era is over. What era is about to begin? So I guess my question for you is, where are we with RG3 in the sense of, does he have a future somewhere else? And if the answer to that question is yes, where do you think it might be?
I think the answer is no. Is he good enough to play in the NFL? Yes, certainly. The problem you have with him, he's an NFL backup. He is. Now, he's a unique backup because of his skill set. We'll get into that. But it's almost a Tim Tebow issue where Tebow's not a good NFL quarterback, but you could argue legitimately that he belongs somewhere on an NFL roster. The problem is he comes with so many distractions because of the allure with him, because of the hype around him, that it's just not worth it. A backup player is not worth all that extra attention and what comes with it. I think it's the same thing with RG3. We're going to hear a lot of stories, Robert, the next few weeks about, well, what's, you know, is he a fit here? Could he be there? Bruce Allen, I think it was, someone with some power said he's going to have his teams to choose from. I don't see it. And maybe he will, a team desperate for QB hype, but I don't see a team looking at RG3 as the stepping stone to getting them, you know, as a foundational piece, a stepping stone to whatever the next level is, because he just has no sense of how to play the game from the pocket.
There are two different types of situations that I could see a team taking a chance on him. The first is a team that doesn't mind warding off that hype and can kind of harbor it and suck it in and just destroy it, like Dallas. I mean, Dallas doesn't mind. If he comes there, I think the idea of him being overpowering as a media force wouldn't be a deterrent for them. And they saw their season completely disintegrate when Tony Romo got hurt. So it's not as if they're not in the market for a backup quarterback. And maybe RG3 is an alternative to saying we need to take a quarterback with the fourth pick in the draft. I understand why you'd want to do that, but at the same time, he's still a guy that he comes with a lot, but they're used to people coming with a lot.
No, I don't disagree, and I think you mean Dallas as a conceptual thing, right? Because the reports out there are that the Cowboys don't feel that he's a fit in Jason Garrett's scheme, which he's not. No, I get what you're saying. I mean, what other teams like? So here, to me, the over under team for RG3 is Buffalo. They've got a guy similar to him and Tyrod Taylor, who I think's a lot better, not a great player either, and probably replaceable. But the Bills could run a standard, if not remedialized, but at least a standard NFL offense with Tyrod Taylor. Would you put RG3? Would you replace Taylor with RG3, a more natural passer, if you were Buffalo?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think that Tyrod Taylor was a better deep ball thrower than Robert Griffin is, and that was such a huge part of their offense this year. It allowed them to sustain offense in the passing game. He just made a lot of plays with his feet, keeping stuff alive and chucking the ball downfield. Because he's not a refined player, you need that element, and RG3 is not going to give you that.
It's interesting. I forgot RG3's. I agree. Taylor's a better deep ball thrower. RG3's a good deep ball thrower, too. That was the one throw that he made with consistency from the pocket when he was with Washington. So what's the fit for him then? Like if you want to bring him in, my thinking is the only reason to bring him in is if you want to revolutionize your rushing attack and do what Carolina did with Cam Newton and present a mobile QB and all the options that come with it. And then that doesn't even get into the discussion, well, can RG3 stay healthy if he ran the ball 7 to 8 times in a game? What else would you bring him in for, though? And if you're doing that, you have to bastardize your passing game to accommodate him still.
I think if you're bringing him in, you're doing it because you don't have a better option and you're trying to grasp at straws to the quarterback position, which we know that happens with teams. If you don't want to spend a high draft pick on a guy and you don't have a guy in-house, you're willing to take a swing on certain people. And that's why I know people like talking about it because of the irony involved. But a team like St. Louis that's moving to LA that needs whatever, I don't think Jeff Fisher wants it, but it's not as if bringing RG3 to LA would be a bad move as you're trying to spark interest in your franchise, and they don't have an answer at quarterback, and they're not going to find one where they're drafting in the first round. So I just think a team like that, schematically, yes, there are always going to be issues, but just from more of an ideological, hypothetical perspective.
I agree. I think that's the best fit for him given all the circumstances involved. So like you said, where is their draft pick?
It's in the middle of the first round, which, I mean, I don't – right. Unless Paxton Lynch falls that far. I believe it's 15. Does that sound right? Maybe it's a little bit higher?
So, maybe they get a guy, a mid-first rounder, that if they really like. But I see what you're saying. There's not a lot of veteran QBs on the market, which there never are. And they don't have anyone in-house. The other thing about St. Louis that could work for RG3 is that's a team that is clearly committed to be built to running the football. They drafted Gurley 1 year after they drafted Trey Mason, who's not a bad runner himself. They've invested in Greg Robinson, a big body mover up front. That's a team built, and they played out of base personnel more than almost any team in the league this year. So if that's the kind of team he needs to go to, though, a run-first team that's willing to play a very limited passing game and build around the quarterback's mobility. And then, but still, Mays, we got to deal with Griffin's going to get hurt. I mean, I hate to say that about a guy, but what coaches have said to me that really makes sense is they especially like to hit Robert Griffin because he's a bad faller. He doesn't protect himself at all, and they say the ground almost gives you two for the money on your hits with Griffin because he just doesn't know how to take hits.
So now we're looking at a situation. Let's move on and keep talking about the Rams for a second. I think the highest profile cuts this week were probably St. Louis because they made the most of them. They cut James Laurinaitis, Jared Cook, and Chris Long. We'll get to Marcus Colson and Antonio Cromartie in a little bit. But all three of those guys have been names at one point in their career. And Jared Cook mostly because of the big deal he just got. It saves them a ton of money in free agency. And that's what you have to look at with these moves, is just how much space St. Louis is going to have after this is done. Right now, based on them saving about $20 million in cap space with those guys, they have $58.3 million, which puts them fifth after Jacksonville, Oakland, the Bears, and the Giants. Does it seem like St. Louis is poised to be a team that can make a couple big moves in free agency and get a little bit more relevant in terms of maybe pushing for a wild card based on some of the stuff you saw from them last year?
Well, first of all, we got to get used to it's Los Angeles, which I'm so glad.
I can't believe I just kept doing that.
I was going to interrupt you, but I didn't notice it till too late because it's not like, oh, he's way wrong. I'm going to do that all off season. So, and I'll only notice it when someone else is doing it, like I have here.
I'm glad I could do that for you.
Yeah. The Los Angeles Rams, let's kind of just break it down move by move a little bit because I think that speaks to where this team is at. The Jared Cook one to me is a case of the guy just wasn't worth the contract he was getting. And that's too bad because he had a chance. And there were a lot of times on film where Cook was in a position to make a play and the ball didn't go to him too, to be fair to him. It was actually a miracle that he didn't have a Sammy Watkins like eruption in the media at some point in this season. But there are also a lot of cases where Cook doesn't make plays he's supposed to make and his salary is way high and he's not the mismatch maker they thought he'd be. So that's that one. The one that surprised me a little bit is Laurinaitis on defense and the savings that they got with him. I think the thinking there would be Chris Long's not surprising, right? Because of his.
No, I mean, just by this point, he didn't really produce the last couple of years. He said that. I mean, he's the one that he came out after it happened and said, I don't blame him. This happened and this makes sense. It's a business. So the Laurinaitis one, he's younger than those other. I mean, I think he's younger than both of them. And he was such a staple of their team. Long had been hurt. Cook was a guy they brought in free agency, didn't work. Laurinaitis is a homegrown guy that even though he wasn't quite the player that everyone's perception of him was, he was still a guy that was just a huge part of what they were as a unit. I mean, he was a captain of that defense for like 3 years.
Yeah, right. And so that's what surprised me, because Long, you save $14 million by cutting, and they've got other defensive ends. They're very deep there. Laurinaitis got them in and out of their packages prior to the snap. He's a chess master out on the field. And in Greg Williams' scheme, that means something. You know, they're not just lining up playing Tampa 2 and calling out, hey, strong side here, weak side there, let's go, guys. I mean, there's adjustments, there's pre-snap disguises, there's wrinkles, there's adjustments on the fly. And Laurinaitis was a big part of that. Now, my guess is, and maybe this is a sign that they're going to simplify. I don't think they will, because Greg Williams he doesn't coach that way. He likes to throw a lot at you, and that's worked for him a lot of years. But my guess is they could be saying, look at all the talent we have around them. Why spend the money here when a placeholder linebacker probably succeeds given the amount of speed and given the utter dominance of the defensive line in front of them, and plus the speed of linebacker around them? Laurinaitis might be a victim of just playing with a lot lot of good players. But I'll tell you, Mays, if without him, they won't be able to do as many different things tactically as they've done in the past. They're not going to just plug in someone else and run the whole Greg Williams scheme. Maybe that's not the worst thing, though, because the better you are, the simpler you can play.
A few things just based on that position on that team. One, you get Alec Ogletree back next year. He's been so frustrating as somebody who likes football and talented players. He's so up and down. He just flashes sometimes and then is maddening other times.
I thought he was more up this year. I agree. I thought he was more up this year. It was really a shame when he got hurt because I thought we were finally starting to see little increments of up, 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 and not the drop downs all of a sudden. But Ogletree, we both agree, is not a guy you'd plug in or not a guy you'd slide at middle linebacker or say, hey, you're calling out the nickel concepts pre-snap, right? I mean, he's an athlete. He's not a guy you're going to put the defensive scheme in the hands of.
Let me run this by you. So with a position where this team is deepest, in my opinion, now that Long is gone, is even more because the defensive end rotation, the edge guy rotation, you have good players there, but it's not a ton of depth. Interior, again, good players. Fairley's gone, not a ton of depth. The area where they have a lot of bodies, it's kind of Arizona-ish. You have Johnson, you have Gaines coming back from injury, you have Jenkins there. I like McDonald. You have Joyner who can play that safety and corner spot. It seems like they may have the situation where, all right, let's have Mark Barron do a Dayon Buchanan, his best debut Dayon Buchanan impression, and let's flood that secondary with bodies and not worry as much about those linebacker spots.
Well, and they did that last year. I mean, Barron became their linebacker, and he even played backer in their base packages after Ogletree got hurt. So I agree with you there that, yeah, okay, we put Barron in at linebacker. Now, they got to re-sign him. He's a free agent. But we put Barron at linebacker. I would re-sign there if I'm him. He'll be an interesting one, by the way, because I'll be curious to see what teams decide his value is on the open market. Because as a Dayon Buchanan, he's very good. But as a safety, he's just another guy. So he's almost a function of what teams need. But maybe they feel, and they got Akeem Ayers at strong side backer, maybe they do feel Ogletree can be the middle linebacker for him. Maybe I'm wrong about the guy's football IQ and they know something I don't know. Their secondary, they've got Tremaine Johnson and Janoris Jenkins both as unrestricted free agents. So Johnson's the one they probably won't let get away. Do you think they can re-sign Jenkins? I mean, he seems like the type of guy that someone else will overpay because of the playmaking prowess.
I don't know, but they'll have the money to do it. That's the thing now. They have $58 million in cap room now. That's by making these moves, that's what it's allowed them to do. They have a ton more flexibility, and they can make the choices that they want to make. So if you do want to retain some of those secondary bodies to give you those options back there, I think that makes a lot of sense.
I think they're going to go for some big signings and free agency on offense. Doesn't it? I mean, we're talking about a defense that's got options here. We keep talking about, oh, maybe they move this good player to that position. Maybe they do. I mean, they got a lot of versatile, talented guys behind a dominant front four again. So offense was horrible for them. They were too easy to play against. They didn't have the players. They could use an upgrade at almost every position except running back. Doesn't this feel like we're talking about a team that's just going to make a big splash signing on offense, maybe one, two, or three even?
I hope so, because I want them to be good. Because if I do happen to be in Los Angeles next year, which there's a chance that I am.
What do you mean, like personally?
Yes.
Like you're going to move?
We'll see. We'll see. I want there to be a good football team there. Someone who spent some time there and would like to have a good team there. I'm interested in them being exciting. So if they can have a couple more guys to go along with the Gurleys and the Donalds, I wouldn't be super upset about it. Let's move on, though, because I could talk about this team forever in a bad way. So not a huge football consequences move here, but Jared Allen retires from Carolina. A lot of the stuff about him that week, one, the way he retired, which I don't know how you feel about this. I was kind of into it. Also, as someone who lives in Boise, Idaho, I feel like you can appreciate the cowboy aesthetic in a way that a lot of people cannot.
Yeah, well, and Allen played his college football at Idaho State. I remember him when I was little. I was younger, and he came to Boise and played and was always getting his name called over the PA system, probably because, you know, no one else on the defense was making a lot of tackles, too. I liked the retirement. In fact, I wouldn't mind that becoming kind of a thing, you know?
Me too. That's what I'm asking. I think I like the trend of it. I like guys. I think there's a downside to the, not for us especially, the amount of outlets that players have by themselves right now. They don't need the media as a conduit anymore. But when it comes to fun stuff like that, I actually enjoy it.
The other one I liked was Marshawn Lynch's, where he just did. Now, he took his cleats. Did he put them over a telephone?
I doubt it.
Because that's, you know, that's usually an indication that, hey, we deal drugs on this street. So, but I liked the creativity of it all. Jared Allen, I was down in the tunnel looking for the food booth, I think, at the Super Bowl before the game. And he came by, the whole team came by in their, you know, their big Super Bowl walk-in thing off the bus. And he had full cowboy regalia on that day. And he wore it well, too. You know what I mean? Like, it's a man that gets now, every cowboy hat makes you taller, but he's a man that really lives taller with a cowboy hat on.
I've always considered myself to be that as well. Okay. Wear a lot of cowboy hats. Yeah, I live taller with a cowboy hat on. I don't ever wear them in public, but I just like to, when I'm walking around the house,
how
I like to be taller.
Have you worn a cowboy hat in your life? How many?
We're still sitting at zero. It's a gentleman's 0 days.
I wore them a little bit when I was a kid for like, you know, every other. I went through a little cowboy stage as a kid.
That really is informative. I'm glad to know that now. So the Jared Allen stuff is more. I think that it's just worth talking about Jared Allen's place for his career. I mean, the guy has, I believe, 138 sacks. I think that's right. I probably should have prepared for this podcast.
Well, you run our outline here in a 22-sack season.
He had a 22-sack season, and that season is one of the best seasons a pass rusher's ever had, obviously. And I believe, I'm going to get this wrong, I think it was Chase Stewart who did a little bit of a sack rate thing where he talked about the amount of snaps he got and based on that, the impressiveness of that 22-sack season. And it was one of the more impressive pass rushing seasons of all time. So what's the total number?
136.
Oh, I was pretty close. Yeah. So it's eighth all time. Obviously, sacks are a relatively new stat. We've had them for long enough that a lot of the big name guys have it on their resume. Where would you stack him up against the guys from his generation, which I guess you can consider Peppers, DeMarcus Ware. Peppers is a little bit older. DeMarcus Ware is about the same age. But compared to those guys, where do you think he kind of falls?
I think he falls in that class near the bottom of it. But that's the bottom of the top tier of those guys. He's probably about the eighth or ninth best defensive end of the last 10 years. Maybe better. I mean, his run defense ran hot and cold. And I think it wasn't an effort issue. A lot of times that's an effort issue with guys. With him, I think it was an execution. As he got older, the run defense was, you didn't know what you were going to get. But when he was defending the run, he was as good all around as just about any defensive end in the league. Now, do you dock him for the fact, we talked last week about Muhammad Wilkerson, J.J. Watt, and how these guys move around so much more. Allen was purely a right defensive end in a 4-3 scheme. And when he went to Chicago, when Chicago changed his scheme on him, they traded him relatively soon. He wasn't a fit, and that didn't surprise anybody. Do you dock a guy in these kind of discussions, legacy discussions, for having such a niche type of role?
No. Reggie White was a defensive end for most of his career. I mean, he played inside a little tiny bit. Lawrence Taylor did one thing. DeMarcus Ware has done one thing for his entire career. If you destroy an offense by rushing off one edge the entire time, I think that that's okay. As long as you're a destructive, unstoppable player, which for a huge chunk of Jared Allen's career, he was that, I don't mind that at all.
Yeah, no, I'm on the same page with you. And especially because those guys play in schemes that want that command that kind of approach. So yeah, I agree with you. Where do you put him then?
I think he's behind Ware, and he's behind Peppers. I think he's right after those guys. I don't know. I'm not sure who else would be in there from that class, that era. He's better than OCU Mignora. I mean, I think he's better than that class of guys. Peppers is just
Who else would we put in that class? We got to figure out.
All right, so let's do it this way. Sacks from the time Jared Allen came in the league, which was 2004, until the time he just retired. Who do you think is number one?
Is it him?
It's Jared Allen.
Yeah.
Jared Allen is number one. He has 136. Ware is at 134.5. Peppers is at 117. Okay. So there's essentially two Pro Bowl-type seasons between Julius Peppers and Jared Allen over that stretch. So here's where things get a little bit more interesting. DeMarcus Ware missed way more games. Allen had 187 to Ware's 168. I think that Ware has been the best defensive player in football over times in that stretch.
You mean in the aggregate?
No, for individual seasons, I think he has been the best defensive player in football. There were a couple years there where he should have been and did win Defensive Player of the Year. Jared Allen had 1 year like that. I think Ware had two or three.
Well, Allen, in 2007, he led the league with 15 and a half sacks that year as well. A lot of them were garbage sacks, I recall. Well, I don't mind diminishing a sack, actually. He had 14 and a half his first 2 years in Minnesota, and one of those years, a lot of them were garbage sacks. Anyways, last year in Kansas City, though, he had 15 and a half, but I digress. Go ahead.
I just think that Ware was better. At his peak, I believe Ware was better.
I don't disagree with you.
So that's that. And I also think that Peppers is just such a good run defender, and he just was so good and it took so much attention. I feel like that's really hard to calculate, because if you think about, especially those years in Minnesota, think about who else was on those defensive lines. You got to play with Kevin Williams, who is generally considered one of the best three techniques of all time. Peppers never really had that of help
with Pat Williams as well. The Williams wall, yeah, that was, and they had Antoine Winfield, so you've got run support at the on the edge, at the slot position, and in the nose position. So that does help a defensive end. I would assume he's right between those two positions.
So for me, it's he's after Ware, he's after Peppers. The guy that I feel like is an interesting argument is Freeney. So Freeney's at 95 and a half sacks. He tailed off very quickly, but I also feel like at his peak, Dwight Freeney was as good of a player as Jared Allen was.
Oh, Freeney was significantly better than Allen.
There you go. I mean, do you think that Allen's sustained numbers make him, in the aggregate, is his career better than Dwight Freeney's?
Well, no, because I just said I think Freeney is a significantly better player, but I'm looking at your list here, and Freeney's number 8 on the sack. So, I mean, Robert Mathis.
Sacks aren't the be-all end-all.
Of course not, but that's, you got to start somewhere to begin the discussion. How about Terrell Suggs? Do you put Freeney ahead of Suggs, and then therefore whoever loses that, do you put Allen ahead of him?
That's such a good question. I don't know.
I think Suggs.
I probably do too. Again, the run defense and everything else.
Right. I think the run defense, the versatility. Okay, so let's look at another guy. Mario Williams. I get tired.
No, thank you.
Yeah, right. Doomerville and Mathis are kind of...
Pass.
Pass.
I'm all set.
You like Allen?
As good as Jared Allen.
John Abraham, who's number 5 on your sack list here in the last 10 or 14 years. And keep in mind, Abraham has fewer seasons than Allen. He was done in 2014. So he's got one.
He has 40 games less.
Yeah, and he was, what, his sack number is 100? Mm-hmm. So do you put John, who's better? And Abraham played in a more diverse scheme and actually played in two different types of schemes, because he was good in Atlanta as a rush end and then as a 3-4 backer, which I know you feel is the same thing as an end, and I agree. But you know what I'm saying. And if we're talking run defense now, then those 3-4, 4-3 delineations mean a little bit of something. Over under on John Abraham versus Jared Allen.
I think I rather would have had Abraham's career, because he was so good for so long. He had that second act. He also was pretty decent in Arizona for that last year. Allen held off his last 2 years. It's close, though. It's close. All right, let's move on, because we can talk about this forever.
Wait, real quick then. Allen Hall of Famer or not?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I definitely think he is. If he's in the conversation, one of the 5 best defensive ends of an entire 10-year stretch, he has to be, right?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, I'd say he's a Hall of Famer. It's weird because I've never quite thought of him that way. And I wonder if it's because he's like a good old boy and he doesn't quite have a superstar dynamic personality. I don't know what it is. But as a football player, I think he's as good as any of these guys we're talking about. He belongs in that discussion with them all.
So if we're looking at similar players on Pro Football Reference here, for his career, the similar player list is Howie Long, Kevin Williams, Richard Seymour, Neil Smith, Haloti Ngata, Leroy Glover, Richard Dent, and John Randall. That's probably a guy that belongs in the Hall of Fame.
That's a lot of defensive tackles, though.
Sure, I mean, it is, but I think there's a lot of production there. I think they do it for approximate value. It's not the comparative other stats. So I think that list of names, that guy belongs in the Hall of Fame. That's just me.
I'll go with you. Let me put it this way. If Jared Allen gets voted in, I don't raise an eyebrow at all. I have no problem with him being in the Hall of Fame if he gets in.
All right, let's move on, because, again, we can talk about that forever. Antonio Cromartie and Marcus Colston both get cut. Not surprising. Both guys definitely near the tail end. The Cromartie, he had one really – that good year in Arizona 2 years ago was good. But it's not surprising he would fall off a little bit after getting paid again. the Jets could have gotten out of that contract easily. They did. The Saints can save a bunch of money by cutting Colston. This is just what happens at this time of year. I mean, that's kind of how I feel about it. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I would expect Cromartie to return to the Jets on a lesser deal. I wouldn't be surprised. I think he likes it there in New York. You know, Antonio Cromartie, because he's got all those kids, we think he's probably just like a raw talent, kind of in and kind of out type of guy. Coaches tell you he's as dedicated and precise about the game as anyone they've ever seen. In fact, the issue in Arizona with him was that he would take too many notes, way too diligent, wanted too many cut-ups of film. They got concerned after a while because it's like, well, I want to see every time the guy was in the slot in the third quarter on second down and seven to go in the last 8 years. Can you give me a cut-up of that? You know, they thought he would over-prepare.
Those poor film guys.
Yeah, yeah. So, fortunately, it's easier to do that now than back in the day. But Cromartie, he's a high football IQ type guy. I bet he stays in a system that he likes with Todd Bowles that he's good at. He wasn't worth quite as much as they were paying him. But if he's your number two cornerback, you're in a good spot with the Jets. And I think, again, you can't emphasize enough, that's a complex scheme in Arizona. Well, New York now, but Todd Bowles runs a complex scheme. So to have a corner who's familiar with it, I think that'd be pretty valuable. So I would imagine the Jets want him back as well.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. And he knows that scheme. You're right. It's a complex scheme. Guys that have familiarity with it have way more value than guys that do not. I totally understand that. Colston, this is just a team that has such money problems. Not surprising at all. They have to make moves like this pretty much every year. It just happened to be his time.
What'd they say by cutting him?
So looking at it right now, it's about $3.2 million, which isn't an exorbitant amount, but when you're the Saints and you're always playing right up against it, that's enough money that will give you a little more flexibility.
Right, and I think, keep in mind, they feel that they can replace him with Brandon Coleman. There's a few guys how it's kind of like, it seems almost inappropriate anymore or politically incorrect to say Alex Smith's a game manager, even though he's exactly 100% the classic game manager. It's almost like that with Colston, like, well, he's just a guy in a good scheme. And people say, no, he's a seventh round steal. He is a guy in a good scheme. And all the credit to him. That's what you're supposed to be in the end. That's a good NFL career you put together when you're that. But you can find other Marcus Colstons. He doesn't play on the perimeter. Nobody double teams him. He works well with the Saints because they do a good job of getting into seam routes down the field numbers, right down the middle of the field where Breeze is most effective throwing. And when you do that, especially against zone defense, you get whoever's in the middle of the field matched against a linebacker. So Colston made his career beating linebackers and safeties on seam patterns, and he and Breeze practiced those probably as much as any receiver in QB practiced any one route, is from what I hear, and all the credit to him. That's great. He's had a wonderful career, but if some team thinks that they're going to sign Marcus Colston and they're going to get 70 catches from him for 800 yards, it's not going to happen, not at this point in his career, and it never would have. He's got to play in a system like the Saints. So they think they can plug in Brandon Coleman in that role or probably draft somebody to do it, and I wouldn't be surprised if they do.
Let's one more kind of scheme-based conversation here. We've talked about this a lot in however long we've discussed the offseason, especially Chip Kelly getting to San Francisco. The report was from, I believe, Matt Moyoko last week that the 49ers and Colin Kaepernick's people were going to be meeting in the offseason, or meeting at the combine. That meeting may have already happened. It's Tuesday now, so there's a chance that already took place. I thought when they brought Kelly in, it was in a way to salvage Kaepernick and put him in a scheme that would best fit his talent. It seems like now there's a chance they're considering moving on from him. There are financial ramifications of that. Are you at all surprised they're not more willing to say, for this season, we're going to roll with Kaepernick and figure out what we have with him, and maybe after a year with Kelly to see how he fits, we'll consider whether we should move on?
I find myself deliberating on this a lot. This is a fascinating one because let's understand what Kaepernick is. He doesn't study the game a lot. All right, I think you saw the reports that Blaine Gabbert's film log they found had like five times the usage that Kaepernick's did, because they can track that when the players take their film home on their tablets. And he plays like a guy that doesn't study the game a whole lot. So he's not a cerebral QB. That's fine, because in Kelly's system, with the up-tempo, the coverages stay static because defenses don't have time to disguise. So it does help a QB like that. We know Kaepernick's mobile. He can, he He's a long strider, so he probably would be good on the running concepts. The one that gives me pause with him, so those are almost, there's the plus, right? Kaepernick's mobility, of course. The one that gives me pause is you've got to be a quick decision maker after the snap if you play for Chip Kelly, because there are option routes. They're simplified once you know what's going on, but you have to pull the trigger. There's not a lot of deliberating that goes on. That's never been Kaepernick's game. I don't see that becoming his game. I think it would have by now, and I think the Niners understand that. And my guess is that's the pause they're having as well. Is yeah, Kaepernick fits the running scheme perfectly, but in the NFL, at some point you got to throw the football, and I don't know if he's the snappy decision maker that Kelly's system demands.
For me, it's more this, that when you looked at how Nick Foles is successful in that first year, and that seems like forever ago, right? Or that second year.
He's not a snappy guy either, Nick Foles. No. So, yeah.
It's more just that they, a lot of play action and a lot of just simple choices. You have to make them quickly, but they're simple choices. And that's when Kaepernick was best in San Francisco, pulling the ball out of meshes and just throwing it to people. Even if they were a little bit slower developing, they were simple decisions. Harbaugh put him in spots where you said to say, this is where you're throwing the ball. You're going to throw it here, throw it hard, and your guy will catch it. I feel like Kelly can do that for him. So if there is a situation in which he can succeed, this is probably it. But it doesn't seem like San Francisco even cares about making that choice.
I've basically written Kaepernick. I put him in the RG3 class, where immense talent, but I've seen enough, and the talent unfortunately just isn't congruent with exact NFL demands for sustained success. In other words, he's not a pocket player.
And it seems like Chip Kelly may have made that same decision by now.
A little. This is the one that gives me pause. Is if any scheme ever did fit Kaepernick, it would be Kelly's, because of the reasons we've talked about. And like what you said, you're exactly right. It's a quick decision-making thing. So if you could ingrain that in the guy, it almost gets down to how do you coach it? How are you teaching him? If you feel you have someone that could get that through his mind and help him learn and process, because it's a matter of how the guys go about learning. Everyone learns differently. Then I could see it working out. They've got Curtis Modkins at offensive coordinator. He's a running-based guy. He's been a running backs coach in Detroit. He was in Buffalo. He was a coordinator under Chan Gailey, but has more of the running game side. So it's not going to be – Kaepernick doesn't have – that's not going to be the answer there. So someone else will be teaching him. I don't know how Chip Kelly works with QBs. Pat Shurmur did a lot of that in Philadelphia. Who's their quarterback's coach there in San Francisco then? It's Ryan Day. That's right. The guy, they brought him from Philadelphia. I don't know Ryan Day, but my guess is however Ryan Day teaches will be a big part of Kaepernick's success, because he needs very specific type of training. I would like to get to know Ryan Day just to have this discussion with him now. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
totally. Absolutely. It makes all the sense in the world. I think that you're right about that. It's just whether they want to put the effort in to give him that training is an entirely different subject.
And I think, by the way, whatever they ultimately decide will really be an explanation of Kaepernick, because it's going to come down to Trent Baalke. He's going to make the decision, and he's going to have the information that we're looking for. In other words, hey, coaches, how do you feel you can communicate with this guy? And if they decide to get rid of him, that will be the ultimate condemnation on the guy.
While we're talking about the right type of training and getting the right type of information to make quick decisions, let's talk about my problem with tech season and being able to figure out how I do it and how my very weird return actually gets filed. I really am lost when it comes to this type of stuff, and that is why a service like FreshBooks is here to help. For the best way to manage your books and make tax season easy, get FreshBooks, a super intuitive tool that makes creating and sending invoices extremely simple for freelancers and small business owners. FreshBooks stands out when it really counts, getting you paid. You can create and send professional invoices in just 30 seconds. You'll see exactly where your client looked at your invoice you've emailed, tracking the status of all of your outstanding invoices for you. FreshBooks can send late payment reminders to your clients automatically, which means you're not wasting time chasing down and fighting clients for payment. The results speak for themselves. FreshBooks users get paid 5 days faster than average. Don't just take my word for it. Right now, FreshBooks is offering our listeners 30 days of unrestricted use totally free, and you don't need a credit card to sign up. Just go to FreshBooks.com/sports and enter sports in the How You Heard About Us section. That's FreshBooks.com/sports. Enter sports in the How You Heard About Us section. All right, Nindy, let's talk about one more piece of news. And that is the one thing combine-related when it comes to a specific player I will ask you about. Because I know we're in that time of the calendar when we dig into the college guys, and I'm not there yet. I'll readily admit that. This is going to be the first time I've really sucked in the narrative about these guys, the conversations, what Mike Mayock had to say about the guys yesterday, things like that. But the piece that came out this week that I thought was interesting is that Laquon Treadwell, the Ole Miss wide receiver, generally thought to be the best receiver in this draft, is deciding not to run at the combine, which we see this all the time. Guys that are bigger name prospects choosing not to for whatever reason. He's a guy that's a big body receiver. They thought he might not run very well. His excuse was that he hadn't had enough training for the actual 40 to do it. So the only reason I want to ask you about this is I want this to be more of an entry into the way we talk about why the combine matters and whether it does at all. I don't want to ask you whether the combine tests have any impact. They undoubtedly do.
For on a guy's draft status.
Yes.
I mean, it's if you look, I wrote about this today, and the two guys I mentioned from last year, one was Byron Jones. Byron Jones was in no first-round projections at all until the combine. And then the guy breaks the world record in the broad jump, which, why isn't he in the Olympics, first of all? Like, can't he just do it in his spare time if he did it while training for the combine? It just seems like we could send him over there and win an extra gold medal for free.
Well, the problem is you make as much from the Olympics as you do from winning the combine.
Well, it's be a patriot, man. I mean, come on now.
What's his incentive to be a patriot?
I don't know. The gold medal would be pretty sweet. I don't know about that. Just being able to wear around my neck to dinner is something that I would enjoy. So that's another part of it. And then Breshad Perriman was the other guy. Guy who, up and down production in college, had some drop issues, isn't somebody that people loved as a polished receiver, but he's 6'2", 215, and then rips off a 4.25. He's going higher than he would have otherwise. So whether these tests have any bearing on anything doesn't matter. People make decisions somewhat based on them. Is that a problem to you still?
I go back and forth on it, and it's like anything else. You got to have a happy medium with it. So there are some teams, everybody pays attention to it. There are some teams, I remember talking with a guy, and I can say it now because he's no longer there. Bill Pullian was the GM at the time in Indianapolis, and a guy on the Colts front office when they had that regime said, here's how it works. We find guys we like in college, we scout them, and then we root really hard for them on the combine day because we have hard and fast measurables that they have to achieve. And if a guy we like doesn't get the hard and fast meet, then we have to take him off the list. And even Bill Pullian roots hard for guys.
That's exactly what I wrote today, is that the most disappointed people on combine day when people test badly aren't the players. It's the scouts that really fell in love with them. Because the one thing about the testing, I think there are two levels. There are three tiers of it. There's the first tier you have to get over. You have to be over a certain time. If you're a wide receiver, you can't run a 4.75. You just can't do it. If you're a corner, you can't run a 4.6. If you're a running back, you can't run less than 4.73. As long as you get over that, then you're a viable NFL player. And then you get into that tier where if the scouts love you, your film matters and what they saw, and then they start to have a fuller picture. Then there's the highest tier, where if you're just an absolute freak of nature, at some point, it's either going to push you all the way up the draft, or it's going to have somebody take a chance on you and they probably shouldn't. Those, to me, are the three tiers of it. I don't know how you feel about it.
I think that's a good way to put it. And the tier, the positive tier, the guy that goes way up, that room is significantly smaller than the bottom.
Totally.
99 guys out of 100 fail the combine. The one guy out of the 100 passes it with flying colors, and most the other guys, say it's 1,000, the other 900 guys in this 1,000 sample just get what you say. They just pass the test, and now they go on, and okay, they're good enough. The combine's designed to find flaws in guys, and the reason it's here is because the one thing, I'm a film guy, and I believe you study the film, but the film, especially in college, because there's so many players, so many teams, so many systems, there's no way to compare one guy to another in a vacuum, so that's what the combine's for. It's to answer the little nitty-gritty and separate on the smallest decimals for guys within the same context. It's the only time you can put everybody in the same context.
And that's the actual purpose of the combine. The original purpose of the combine is medical testing. That's why they did it. It's because they didn't want team doctors flying around the entire country to test guys. They brought everyone here so you could have a baseline medical test. So that's what it's really doing. It's getting a baseline for everyone, both athletically and medically. If you do happen to score really well, good for you. But it's more just to make sure guys can't be taken off your board entirely. Guys last year, I mean, every year we see this. The two guys last year that I mentioned were TJ Clemmings, who was a guy that some people thought was a first-round pick based on athletic ability, found a stress fracture in his foot, went in the fourth round. And Jay Ajayi, who a lot of people thought could have been a second-round pick, his knee was a mess. And that's the type of stuff that people find at this place. It's either you're not athletic enough to play, and it was very deceptive on film, or your body isn't where it has to be in order to play professional football.
Yeah, I had a coach today tell me that what they're most eagerly awaiting is the measurement of Jared Goff's hands. Because
that's fascinating. I heard about that. I thought it was a little overblown. Maybe not.
Well, there, because the one thing that stands out, I don't know about you, Maze, but whenever I meet a pro athlete, and this went way, I remember I met Drew Bledsoe before I was in the business. I was like writing my own stuff as a hobby, and he came to Boise for an event, and I got to meet him, and his hands were like the size of my forearms in terms of length. They were just huge. It was like shaking hands with a tennis racket. And ever since then, I've noticed the size and strength of athletes' hands are just remarkable. And the guy that coach talked to me today brought up Dante Culpepper and the 9-inch hands. 9.5 inches is kind of the well, yeah, I know. I looked at my hand too. Like, I wonder, I don't know what I would be. We could find out. But the point is, you got to have big hands to play certain positions. And there are people around the league. This was a quarterback's guy. This is a well-known guy who's had success with QBs over the years. He said that matters. It matters a lot in inclement weather. It matters for how much you can trust a guy, the hand size. And so you come, and everyone's excited at the combine this year because what will Jared Goff's hand size be? Carson Wentz was a 10 at the Senior Bowl, 10-inch hands.
Good for him. That seems great. Yeah. I have no idea.
Yeah, no, that's apparently that's very good. But it matters to some people. It matters to guys. And you wonder if they eliminated that and said, you know what, let's not – you want to see his hand size, just watch his film, count the fumbles, count the times the ball wobbles out. Because it's not – it's how you use your hands. It's not – I mean, guy with big hands that has no dexterity is not going to be any good. You wonder if a team were to just eschew all this one year and just go only off film and maybe off of campus visits – if that would help them. No one's ever going to do it because you're so afraid of getting fired in the NFL. But wouldn't it be interesting if a team, as an experiment, just ignored all this for like 2 or 3 years and just saw how it went?
I mean, I think a lot of teams ignore everything but the medical. I mean, I think there are a lot of GMs that just sit there in the stands and it's like, all right, we're good.
You think they outright ignore it? I mean, like, I'm talking about ignore. Like, no scouts, no one comes, nobody shows up. We're not going to send anybody here other than our doctors. The league wouldn't allow it because it's mandatory to attend the combine. People don't know that. But theoretically,
I think there are some teams that in their minds don't really care about the drills. I think there are a lot. There are several teams that probably feel that way quietly. And Bill Belichick has said as much. They need to change the drills, which, whatever. So, I mean, that's a concern in of itself. I think there are a lot of teams out there that don't really value a lot of this stuff. It is the, do they get over those, the hurdles, the lowest hurdle? Do they cross that threshold that we need them to cross? And if they do, we'll figure the rest out later.
Aren't you surprised they don't at least have them in football uniforms and padding on the drills? It would seem like the way you carry your pads would be one, like, I've got 10 buddies, 5 of them might be no good with their running with pads. The other 5, it might not change them that much other than just the normal science of slowing them down, but they're not going to be distracted by it.
That's actually a really good point. Like, the small tweaks you can make to the combine, just put them in football pads. It seems like the guys would really hate that, just having to wear pads for absolutely no reason. But I guess it does make sense. Like, if they're going to play in them, why not?
Or on a 40, why not have, like, kind of like at the dog tracks, have someone have, if they're defenders, give them something to chase. And if they're offensive players, have something chasing them. Because the fastest I ever have been is whenever something's chasing me. It's like that, you just, you know, you're faster.
These are all good ideas. I don't dislike any of these. We will we'll get into more of this stuff later on. I think when we get a little more of what this year's combine is going to be like, I'm sure we'll do another podcast this week at some point. Just chatting about whatever we've seen, whatever impressions we had. But for now, I think that's all we got in terms of pre-combine stuff. I don't know how you feel.
Yeah, no, and I like the idea of other podcasts because we have to justify the expense accounts that we turn in after all these trips.
Totally, and there are tons of people here. We'll get some other people on this week. I wouldn't worry about that. But as for now, we always appreciate you guys listening. Thank you so much, and we'll be back sooner rather than later. Thanks a lot.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team. Every day.